Well, Peter, thank you for a very stimulating lecture. One thing that struck me is you were speaking about all those early scientists, Boyle, Kepler, and so on, and their profound religious belief. Wasn't it just the case that everyone was a profound religious believer in the 17th century? There was no such thing as atheism back then. And so it's just accidental that religion and science were bedfellows in that period.
Yeah, look, I often get this, and the other one is that they were just pretending to be religious for this reason, that if they came out as being atheistic, they'd get in deep trouble. Okay, so, that, I mean, it seems to me that the key answer to this is, can you do the science without the religious presuppositions? Okay, and in the case of people like Kepler and Newton and Boyle, you can't get the science up and running unless you're assuming that there's an omnipotent God who is instantiating mathematical laws of nature in the universe. And this is very clear from the philosopher Descartes, who really formulates this idea about laws of nature. And it's a very different conception of how nature works to that we see in the Middle Ages. The Aristotelian view about how nature worked was that it was an organic model, that things had within them the capacity to act in particular ways. And what we see for the early modern thinkers who bring about the scientific revolution, they don't think that things have these intrinsic capacities. What they think is that God imposes an order on the world, and that when we discover laws of nature, what we're discovering is quite explicitly the order that God has imposed on the world. And that's why we move from a model of a world that's, for Aristotle in the Middle Ages, like an animal, self-organizing and self-running, to a machine which needs a design and needs something to keep it running, because you can't have a perpetual motion machine. And people often talk about the mechanistic worldview as if it's a kind of world that it is devoid of theological significance, but it's precisely the opposite. It's that mechanical worldview that gives us the idea of God as a designer and an artificer, and of someone who needs to be constantly having causal input to make the world run the way it does. So it can't just be that they're paying lip service to science, although you're quite right to say that it is saturated with religious beliefs. Sorry, lip service to religion. The science won't work without key religious presuppositions.
And you were saying to me earlier today that even ancient Greek science, before the kind of empirical science we enjoy today, ancient Greek science was heavily laden with theological and moral content.
Yeah, I mean, that is to say that when the Greeks were involved in the study of nature, part of it was to do with a kind of project of moral formation. Now, a very good example of this is Ptolemy, and Ptolemy was the brilliant Alexandrian a mathematician, astronomer, who came up with the mathematics that could make the movements of the heavens work with an Earth that was stationary at the centre of the solar system. Now, given that we know the Sun is in the middle and the Earth's going around the Sun, the mathematics to make this work are really quite brilliant and clever. Okay, but what he says in the prologue of the work, where he outlines this theory, is the reason we study astronomy is that we attune ourselves to the motions of the heavens and we become godlike. So the whole purpose of astronomy for this guy is he's aspiring to be a particular kind of godlike person. And this is an ancient idea that about theosis, that the aim of life is to become, in certain respect, like God. And this is what motivates the study of nature at this time for certain people.
I have questions coming into me on my iPad as we speak, and let me encourage you to send your questions to the phone number and the hashtag, and I'll keep reading them. Here's an interesting question that I think relates to one of your books with Cambridge University Press. Many think the biblical idea of human fallenness or sin has stunted human advancement. But you've argued it's actually partly responsible for the advance of science itself. That sounds implausible.
Okay. Yes, it sounds implausible. And what I like to do as a historian is to take an implausible thesis and show why it's absolutely true. Okay. It's a thing that Karl Popper talked about this in science. He said, look, in a sense, any scientist can prove what's obvious. The real trick is to show something that's really counterintuitive. And I like to do that historically. And it's counterintuitive to suggest that a Christian anthropology, that is a Christian view of human nature, that says as a consequence of our fallen condition, our intellectual and sensory capacities are limited. That would suggest an anti-knowledge and anti-science position. But in fact, in the context, in the 17th century, when this particular anthropology, this particular Christian view became quite prominent, it had the capacity to revolutionise science and to bring into existence the whole experimental approach to the natural world. And in a nutshell, this is how it worked. The standard science in the Middle Ages was based on Aristotle, and Aristotle's science, although you often hear talk about Greek science as being armchair science, it wasn't necessarily. Aristotle's science was based on observations, no doubt about that. But what kind of observations were they? They were normal observations of nature as it normally operated. So Aristotle has this idea that if you mess with nature, what you're looking at is not nature anymore. You're looking at what he called violent motion. Or if you look at machines, you're not looking at nature. You're looking at something that's artificial, right? Basically, he thinks that if you look at nature as it normally runs, you'll get a pretty good sense of how things really are. And to take a simple example, if you drop a lead weight and you drop a feather, the lead weight accelerates or falls much more quickly than the feather. Common sense observation about nature under its normal conditions. Does that actually give us insight into how nature really works? In the 17th century, they say, no, it doesn't. And they say, no, it doesn't, because they no longer trust our intuitions or instincts, and they don't trust them because they buy into this Christian understanding of our intellect being very limited. Moreover, they also think, Aristotle thought the world was the world, and that human beings were naturally attuned to know it. There was a kind of important reciprocal relation between the world and its knowability and our capacity in our minds to know it. The Christian doctrine of the fall said that is cut, that is breached. Now, what follows as a consequence of that is, in order to know something about nature, it's going to be hard work. We've got to be very critical about our observations. We have to observe under strict experimental conditions. We have to do it repeated numbers of times. We have to accumulate vast amounts of experimental data. We need to do it over long periods of time. We need to have lots of people involved in it. So the idea of science as a cumulative, corporate, critical and experimental endeavour is actually grounded on this rejection of Aristotle's idea that science is easy, and it's like, no, actually science is hard, and it's hard because the natural world has fallen and resists our attempts to know it, therefore we need to manipulate it and experiment on it, and ourselves as individuals are limited in what we can know and see, therefore we need lots of us working for long periods of time under experimental conditions.
And in Peter's book, The Fall of Man and the Rise of Science, he lays out in amazing detail. This is exactly how the scientists spoke about their project. It's extraordinary. A question that perhaps has Lawrence Krauss in mind.
Some scientists believe that science will discover the origins of the universe independent of God. Isn't this then the same sphere of study as religion?
Okay, yeah. So this is a very good question as to whether, let's say, what's the Christian talk about this stuff? It's the doctrine of creation. And what's the scientific talk about? It's about origins. And don't these overlap? Isn't this overlapping territory that gives rise to the competition? And the answer is no, it's not. Okay. Now, I'm tempted to go off topic here and talk about how Krauss just can't get into his head that nothing...
Go off topic. Okay. Peter, go off topic.
So Krauss has this argument that somehow the Big Bang theory explains how you get something from nothing. It doesn't. There must be laws and constants in place in a quantum vacuum for the Big Bang to take place. It's not nothing. It's a set of conditions that make this possible. Right, and what's very interesting, of course, is these conditions and laws and constants happen to be quite significantly fine-tuned, unless you buy into a multiverse understanding, which again is quite legitimate, but often is assumed on the basis of actual religious or non-religious beliefs. But anyway, to go back to the what's the difference between a Christian doctrine of creation and a cosmological doctrine of origins? The Christian doctrine of creation essentially argues that however the world came into existence, it is radically dependent for its existence on God. It's not about origins. And we had a conversation this afternoon about Aristotle's view that the world was eternal. And Aquinas uses Aristotelian arguments about the first cause. God is the first cause. But what Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas, the medieval, great medieval Dominican thinker, what Aquinas means when he talks about God as the first cause is not God as the first temporal cause, the first beginning cause, but God as the fundamental cause that underlies all causation. So whenever you have causation, says Aquinas, you have God. So it's logically possible, he said, that the world has always been in existence, that the world has always existed. Nonetheless, you would still need God because an infinite series of causes still requires an explanation, just as a first something that comes out of nothing requires an explanation. So even if science were to show us that the world had always existed, it would not take away the question about creation, which is to say, what explains the eternal existence of the universe? What is the fundamental underlying primary cause that makes all of that possible?
On Aquinas and Aristotle, someone's just texted in a very erudite question. Aristotle's work was made available to the medieval period largely thanks to the preservation and translation by Muslim scholars, extensively used and then deployed by Thomas Aquinas, by far the best synthesis between Christian philosophy and Christian revelation. What do you think of Aquinas' contribution to Aristotle's thought? And why do you think Muslim scholars today are no longer at the forefront of this integration?
Well, there's a simple question. Okay. Look, let me start with the Muslim one and then I'll come to Aquinas. The Muslim question is very interesting because historians don't have laboratories to test their ideas, but they do have comparisons with other cultural traditions. And that helps us see what the key variables are. And what I've suggested to you is, well, very much quickly in passing, we see science in China, we see remarkable science and technology in China, we see it in medieval Islam, we see it in medieval Christianity, we see it in ancient Greece. Where does science consolidate? It consolidates in the West from the 17th century onwards and nowhere else. So the trick to science is not inventing stuff and coming up with good ideas. The trick to science is consolidating it, and the trick to consolidation is valuing it. And the trick to valuing it is giving it social legitimation. And the story that historians like me and Stephen Gorkroger believe about what legitimates science in the West uniquely is that initially it gets Christian legitimation as a genuinely religious activity. Uh-huh. And that's the difference between this and all the boom-bust patterns that we see in other situations. Now, Thomas Aquinas, I think is very interesting. I'm a big fan of Aquinas. But when Aquinas brings Aristotle on board, you might say this is a very interesting example of science and religion getting on very cosily, and in a sense it is. But from the 17th century perspective, and this is when modern science gets up and running, what Aquinas did was to be too uncritical about the premises of Aristotelian thought. And one of the premises of Aristotelian thought, as I've said to you already, is that you can have an uncritical observational-based knowledge of nature, and that's going to be good enough, and it's not. The other thing that they argued about Aquinas is that Aristotle had no doctrine of creation, and the argument is that when Aquinas brings Aristotelian thought into Christian, this beautiful synthesis, he also tends to overlook the significance of creation. And the significance of creation is that if God makes the world is an artifact. And that's completely inconsistent with Aristotle's view that says the artificial and the natural, this is a Greek idea, the artificial and the natural are totally different. So you get no insights into how nature operates by studying artifacts that are made, whereas in the 17th century, motivated by a doctrine of creation that God made the world, they say, no, actually, machines, mechanics, is directly relevant to the operations of nature. This was never part of Aristotelian thought. So that the mechanical worldview arises out of a rejection of Aristotelianism and, in a sense, out of a rejection of Aquinas' incorporation, brilliant though it was, of Aristotelian thought into Western Christendom.
You've shown that the social sciences and the arts are more strongly correlated with non-religiousness. Is it perhaps more accurate to say that it's philosophy and the arts that make religion obsolete?
Okay. No, I don't think that's because what I'm trying to show is that religion's not obsolete for any but a few places in Northern Europe and a few intellectual elites who talk to each other and for this reason think that secularisation is universal. But you only have to look at the maps to see that that's not the case. But look, if we ask the question, what is corrosive of religious belief in the educational system? And as I said, it's not science. I think it's the incipient relativism that comes with some ways of studying the humanities. Plus, as part of what I was trying to show is if you look at the filiation of the social sciences, right at their heart, they were opposed. From the very point of their origin, they were explicitly opposed to religion. And Kant is an example. Marx is clearly an example. The whole point of sociology is to displace religion. And although you won't find contemporary sociologists explicitly saying that, it's in the DNA of the discipline. It's in the DNA of the discipline that this is actually this whole activity is a secular replacement of a religious anthropology. And that's what's going on. So that's why I think this psychology and the social sciences are so hostile to religion, is that here we do see a genuine grappling over the same territory, the human subject. And that's where you do see, I think, the potential for conflict and the most serious conflicts, because here is competition for the same territory. How do we explain the human person? Well, how do you explain human society? And sociology and psychology have a series of responses to that. Now, I'm not saying you can't be a Christian and a psychologist. I'm not saying you can't be a Christian and a sociologist. Clearly, there are significant Christian sociologists. Peter Berger would be one of them. But the discipline itself bears, as I say, in its DNA, I think, the tendency to be of a particular kind.
Another question about the humanities, which is good because you're the director of a Centre for Humanities, right?
Right, I should know about this.
So, again, sort of picking up from that previous question, modern humanities have become a battleground for faith. Is it true, though, that a strong argument can be made that the real origins and development of the humanities was also enabled by the early church fathers and the doctrine of the image of God, almost parallel to the scientific revolution? Have you studied this and got any comments for this big debate?
Okay, no and no. that's easy. Look, the humanities, I'm interested in the history of science. The humanities is a discipline, you know, it's very interesting whether Renaissance humanism is really the key thing here. And again, there's very interesting questions about the relationship between Renaissance humanism and the Christian tradition. I mean, we know Erasmus, of course, one of the best known humanists, is clearly very much committed to religious beliefs. But the idea of the humanities, whether it arises out of, it's... For me, the case is much more obvious in respect to science. Let me just say that.
You talked about the clash between, you know, Mother Church, the Roman Catholic Church, and Galileo. But this question wants to ask, what were the Protestant reformers' reactions to the Copernican theory?
Okay, yeah, that's a very interesting question. Largely indifference. It's one of those guys I put up on the board. Teacher days here, on the slides, Andrew Dixon White's History of the Warfare of Theology with Science and Christendom. He actually has an invented quote from Calvin that talks about Copernicanism, and no one's ever been able to track it down. Luther, in his table talk, spoke about that fool Copernicus, and the table talk, we don't know about how accurate that was. So a lot of people thought Copernicanism was crazy. As I said, the scientific consensus thought that. We wouldn't expect that the Protestant reformers who came somewhat, well, actually, no, that they would be significantly different. But what's very interesting is that Protestants jumped on board Copernicanism quite early, and the first people to use Galileo as anti-religious propaganda were actually Protestant propagandists arguing that what the Galileo event showed was that Catholicism was regressive and intolerant. So the first, and then that actually, those arguments were then adopted by philosophers in the French Enlightenment and broadened into a general critique of religion.
So Protestants are to blame for this whole thing.
Oh, that's right, it's the Protestants' fault.
Shame on you.
I mean, John Milton, for example, he visits Galileo and says, look at this awful thing the Catholics did. So, in fact, you do get this Protestant historiography that says the Catholics are responsible for the Dark Ages. And as I say, this is then adopted by the Enlightenment critics of religion who say, well, it's not just the Catholics, it's religion in general.
We need to bring this shortly to a close with a couple of questions about tone and direction. You were professor at Oxford in science and religion at the time. You mentioned just in passing, at the time, Richard Dawkins was hugely famous for his discussions about science and religion. What's your general impression of the tone of the debate about God and science around Dawkins?
Yeah, well, you know, the problem with the new atheists is that unlike the old atheists, and I'm talking about people like Nietzsche and Sartre, who were very philosophically sophisticated and really knew what they were against, people like Richard Dawkins have significantly lowered the tone of the discussion. So it's not, for me at Oxford, it wasn't possible to engage with Richard Dawkins because he wasn't operating at a level where arguments worked. That this was largely, it's polemic. And the way polemic works is you pick the most extreme examples and you magnify these and make them representative of the whole. So it's dead easy to pick cases of extreme religious fundamentalism or, you know, the odd passage in the Old Testament and then say, and this is what religion is. But it's such a crude tactic. It's not interested in finding out what the truth is. It's not interested in a genuine discussion. And the way a genuine discussion works is that you seek to find the strongest version of the argument that you oppose, and then you see how your arguments work against that. And Richard Dawkins was never interested in that kind of discussion. And in fact, when my I remember an undergraduate wanting to do an essay on Richard Dawkins, and one of the examiners said, you're an undergraduate, you really need to pick a target that's worthy of you as an Oxford undergraduate. So.
And perhaps the last question, how do we rewrite the narrative of a conflict between science and religion? Can you give us some tips?
Look, no, I can't. It's something that's very interesting. Next week, I'm going to a conference at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, The Myth That Wouldn't Die. And the myth that wouldn't die for we historians of science is the myth of an enduring science-religion conflict. And we have been doing so much hard historical work. And as I say, this is not religious apologetics we're engaged in here. This is history of science, saying, look, actually, there's no perennial struggle between science and religion. We can't get that message through to certain segments. And the reason is that I think for certain worldviews, people need to believe that. People need to believe that there was a conflict between science and religion. It's achieved a kind of mythical status that makes rational a set of present beliefs about the contemporary world. And that's why someone like Richard Dawkins, who knows nothing about history, will say in that quote I put up, you know, religions historically have always attempted to answer the questions of science answers. Now, he knows nothing about history, and if he did, he'd know that that was simply not the case. But he needs to believe that for him to be able to say what he says about the present. And I think that's true for a number of people who want to argue about, you know, the fact that science is going to trounce religion and that religion's about irrationality and that science is about irrationality. They need to have a historical myth that grounds that conviction that they have. And that's why it's very hard to dislodge this myth.
I need to end it there to end on the advertised time. This has been a great night, but if you want more, we took Peter to ABC Studios today, and on Sunday night you'll hear a really interesting interview with John Cleary on Radio National. Actually, it'll be on all ABCs around the nation, all your local ABCs around the nation, from 10 o'clock. And Peter got to suggest his three favourite tracks to break up the interview. And although you would expect the Boffin to have Bach and, you know, such things, did we not open with Midnight Oil?
We did. But there is some Bach there as well. Yes. Okay.
So there are layers upon layers with Professor Peter Harrison. Will you thank him for his time tonight?